Susie Wales, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Speaking of someone whose career
has taken weird turns.
Weird turns, and it's not easy to do that as an academic because the system's a little bit less flexy than other options.
Indeed.
But always lovely to have you at time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, the minor birds,
yes.
Aren't they those squawky things that one hears when one is travelling? See you now.
Yeah. I didn't
know we had them here.
Yeah, so I'm kind of fascinated by them. I've got family up in the Bay of Islands, and so whenever we travel from Auckland, you know, up north, they're basically the birds that you spend the entire journey kind of dodging because they're just amazing. They spend a lot of their time on the road trying to find like road-killed insects, and they've got, you know, they really leave it till the last minute before they get out of your way. So you just feel like you're going to, you know, like either dodging them or you're going to hit them. So they're kind of little brown birds and they've got sort of orange beaks and orange colors around their eyes. And then as they leave, you get this flash of white because they've got kind of a white strip under their wings. So, yeah, that's the minor birds. And they're native to Southern Asia, but they're basically now established on every continent in the world except Antarctica. So we have them here. In fact, they're on the International Union for Conservation of Nature's list of top 100 invasive species. And the birds have obviously like moved themselves, but they've also actually been introduced to many countries, including into New Zealand. And one of the reasons they were introduced here was to control insects on farmlands. And so there's this really fantastic study that's just been published where a team of researchers from the University of Auckland, led by Dr. Heather Battles, have basically trawled through like newspapers and journal articles and also the sort of records of these things called acclimatization societies, which were little societies set up to essentially import animals
From the homeland,
from
often,
the homeland,
wasn't it?
From
possums,
England, right?
Deer.
To make New Zealand more like
rabbits,
yeah, like England. And so her and her team have trawled through all their records to look at when the minor birds were introduced into New Zealand, and it's just like super fascinating. So, the earliest reliable record they've got is the importation of two birds to Nelson in 1868, and what's really interesting is that the birds were more or less, if they were imported from overseas, they generally came from Australia. So they'd obviously been established in Australia and then they came to Australia here. So we had those two birds in 68. And then in 1970, there was another importation to Nelson from Australia of about 20 birds. Then we get them imported from Melbourne to Christchurch. So that was like 1971. And then several times between 71 and 75, there's basically importations to Wellington. So we've got several importations to different parts of New Zealand from Australia in the kind of 1800s. The last sort of record of them coming from to the South Island seems to be a private individual, so don't know who that was, who imported four birds into Dunedin. So then they are in Dunedin. And then after that, we kind of get lots of importations into the North Island, but they're generally in those societies in New Zealand sending them to each other. And then the last time seems to be a transfer of birds from Napier to Gisborne in about 1882 or 1883. Okay, so you might be wondering, why do we care, right? Because if we know where they started and we look at where they are now, there are some considerable differences, right? Which tells us a lot about the bird's kind of range, but also might help us understand, you know, if we can understand these as an invasive species and how they've moved, we might be able to understand both where they're going to go in the future, but also, you know, understand other invasive species. And what I love about the paper is they've got this map that shows the distribution kind of taken from sightings and records of them at four different time points in New Zealand. So the 1870s to 1880s, which is basically, you know, those introductions. So Dunedin, Wellington, Nelson, Christchurch. And then we've got the 1900s to the 1910s, where we can start to see the birds establishing in the North Island. Then there's the 1930s to 1940s, where we start to see their range kind of getting bigger. And then the 1960s to 2010s, where they're kind of pretty much where they are today, which is huge amounts of the North Island. And it's sort of interesting because So basically, these are birds that prefer, you know, the temperatures of the kind of upper North Island. But there was this little, that little community that was introduced into Nelson actually managed to survive near Nelson until about the 1960s. And then it obviously was just not the right conditions and they kind of died out. But yeah, it's basically they were reaching the Auckland by the 1940s and then the top of the North Island by the 1960s. And that's kind of where they've stayed until relatively recently. So they kind of died out in Wellington because that was too southerly for them. But they've recently started to be found again in Wellington. So they're kind of recovering, possibly due to climate change. So it's sort of telling us a little bit about where we might expect these birds in the future. And this is also kind of important because, like, not only are they, you know, they were introduced to get rid of insect pests, but they're actually, they attack crops, fruit. So they're actually, you know, they're considered pests too. And so what impact this might have about how their range expands in terms of our agriculture in the future is an important thing, I think, to know about.
Yes. How do they cope in the wind? Because there's a bit of that around here at the moment, I can tell you. First the northerly and then the southerly.
Indeed.
All right. Now, software-controlled cooking. Okay,
yes.
I think we're going to get this up on the web.
Oh, I just, when I saw this story, I was like, I have to share this with you. So it's a paper that's just out in a journal called The Science of Food, and it's basically a kind of perspectives paper on the future of cooking. And basically what they mean by kind of software controlled cooking is the use of 3D printers, but also actually the use of lasers. And so will we one day see our microwaves, you know, our ovens replaced by 3D printers and lasers? And so to kind of, I guess, test their theory or prove their point, they set out to make a cheesecake with 7 different ingredients. So they're Americans, so it was graham cracker as their kind of like, you know, biscuit base, peanut butter, Nutella, banana puree, strawberry jam, cherry drizzle, and some kind of frosting. And honestly, I mean, it's not my ideal cheesecake, but anyway, you know, they wanted a range of ingredients that they could make into a paste of some sort that they could then, you know, because the whole point of about 3D printers, it's got to be extruded through a nozzle, right? So it needed to be something that could go through a nozzle. They wanted different kind of consistencies. And then they basically set about programming their 3D printer to try to make a slice. So it was a slice that would stand on its own of this kind of cheesecake. And so hopefully we'll manage to get a video up because it is hilarious.
It is up. I've just watched it. I'm not sure that I'm in a hurry to eat it, however.
So you see them, you know, trying to figure out, like, so how would you make something that was structurally sound? And, you know, it's just some of their attempts as they're just laying layer after layer, they all just kind of collapse into the sort of heap. You know, they found that basically if they used that kind of graham cracker mix, which is sort of a bit more stodgy, they could kind of use that as like a base for each layer. So things would sort of stay on top of that. They used the more dense ingredients like the Nutella and the peanut butter to make sort of like little containers, like a pool to hold the sort of softer or runnier ingredients, which is kind of awesome. And then what was really cool was, you know, not just printing, because, you know, 3D printing is used in food already, right? You know, there's been chocolate printers for ages, so people can make amazing, and I think Giappo is one of the people who makes amazing things, right, with their chocolate. This is kind of combining ingredients, but then at the end of that, using a laser to basically cook it. And the thing about lasers is you can control essentially the energy, so the temperature, and you can make it cook in very defined places. And so what they're sort of arguing is that, you know, this is only the beginning of like mixing all these things, but, you know, what's the future going to look like if we can use these to make incredible, like, not only just like flavor combinations, but also being able to do things like, nutrients, you know, making really defined or precise kind of nutrient amounts of nutrients and things. And then, using this thing to cook them. And the other argument they make is that because they're machines, you can also sort of remove some of the human handling. And that may well have important consequences for disease, right? So depending on how hygienic you are, it might be best to make things through a 3D printer. Although, of course, in my line of work, I know all about the organisms that live, that can
exactly.
live inside of these machines. So they'd have to be cleaned very well too.
When there's anything, there's an organism. Now, just very quickly, that the next round of boosters is becoming available. Vaccine boosters are becoming available 1st of April, I think, isn't it? And what is it the Australian researchers have done with an online tool?
Yeah, so they've this is really just to try and get people to understand what are the risks of various things like myocarditis and stuff, or even catching COVID or being hospitalised with vaccines versus versus COVID. And so the thing about the tool is it only goes up to 3 doses. So obviously for some of us it's number 4 or number 5 that we'll soon be able to get. But it's also really interesting to see with every dose how your risk, you know, lowers for those things. And I think it's really good for people who are concerned about the vaccines to actually see just how different the risk is, like orders of magnitude compared to getting COVID, for example. But what's really cool about it is they've also included children. So I think this is, you know, we know that a lot of our children haven't had 2 doses. You know, our over 16s are going to be eligible for doses. So it's a really good tool because you can basically go in, you can put your age, and then you can, then it shows you for your age, this is what the risk is of these things from COVID and stuff. It's a really, really cool little tool. It'll be quite similar, I think, for New Zealand. So if you're, you know, just wavering a bit, go and have a play with it. Go and see what difference the vaccines make.
Thank you so much. Susie Wales is our science correspondent today. She is based at the University of Auckland, of course.